This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR on 8:55 a.m. on the dial. It's me and Izzy.
Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning, Hannah.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Yay.
Yay.
And how was your weekend?
It was good. My coffee machine is broken right now.
Oh.
So I was coffeeless today, but that's okay.
That's not okay, to be honest.
We survive.
Yeah.
My weekend was good. Last week, I went to Goongra, where I grew up.
Oh, lovely.
With my mum.
So nice.
It was lovely. We went on a little road trip. We drove through the plateau, through the beautiful rainforest.
Stunning.
And then out onto the coast, and we camped on Cape Conran in my car.
You're joking.
We put my car to the test, and it passed the test.
Oh my gosh, and I'm so proud of it.
Me too, honestly. I was like, it's gonna die.
But no, it didn't. Subarus last for life.
Yeah.
It is a Subaru, isn't it?
It is, yeah. The 320,000
Ks. Oh, my goodness. You know,
what's a couple more?
Honestly, test it to the limits. Yeah. And I love that. Yeah. I feel like rural Victoria is stunning.
It's gorgeous.
It has so much to offer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It was so nice being in the forest.
Yeah.
Really sad to drive back to Melbourne from that beautiful...
Honestly.
Oh, yeah. Like, it was beautiful, sunny.
Yeah.
And then back in Melbourne, raining, cold, sad.
Concrete.
Gray.
Cold, sad, and concrete. Gray. That's it, honestly. Well, my weekend was extremely Melbourne-coded.
Yeah.
No nature, which makes me so sad. But I did go to this really cool gig just off Hoddle Street, crazy street. But it's in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And... it was like a jazz gig.
Oh, nice.
Which was so fun. I was like, okay, jazz. Okay, jazz 2026. I'll buy it. I'll come. $40 ticket. Definitely like a mixed crowd, but everyone was dancing, having a good time. It was like DJs and, you know, like a live jazz gig mixed with some DJs. So it was cool. It was fun.
I love a jazz boogie.
It was really good. And I mean, I don't know. These people are just out there with crazy skill.
People are so talented.
It's wild.
Every time I see live music, I'm like, wow.
No, I know. Live music is just, it's honestly the best.
It truly is.
And it just brings people together, and it's just like someone's amazing skill and talent that you just get to, like, you know, hang out and watch. Like, that's so bananas. Thanks for letting me do that.
Yeah, thanks, musicians.
And it was the first weekend of, like, being cold, chilly Melbourne.
That's nice.
Yeah.
I think that Melbourne is good. Like, some, you know, you can romanticize the sad, cold.
You absolutely can. It's just that it lasts so long. But it's, if I'm so being honest, like, growing up without seasons, like being it's wet or dry season in Queensland, having the seasons here, I go back and forth of being like, oh, I can't handle it. But then it happens and I'm like, what a treat. What a dream.
Yes.
That it's not 40 degrees today. I'm stuck inside, you know, like it's so cold out and chilly. You just got to have the right jacket. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
North Face, let's go.
let's get out down jackets.
Let's do it.
Yeah. As soon as I got back to Melbourne after driving for 7 hours, I did go to a gig and it was nice. Like, oh, yay, let's go back to Melbourne and see some beautiful live music, which makes it better.
Absolutely.
There's stuff going on here.
You just go touch the grass when you can.
Yeah. I want to start going to the bush like once a month.
I think that's, you've actually got to plan it and book it.
Yeah.
I have not done that living here for 2 years. And I think that's caused some issues for my brain.
Well, it was going to be more frequent than once a month, but like I was just like, let's be honest with myself.
Yeah, so that's not going to happen more than that.
Yeah.
It's too busy. Life is busy.
Life is busy. I have a mattress that perfectly fits in the back of my car, so I just want to just drive to the bush and camp there whenever I want.
Oh, my gosh. It's going to be great. Hannah, you're going to have the best life. You're set.
Truly, dreams come true.
They really do, guys. They really do, and that's what we have to share today. If you want a Les Brew, you can get one.
Get your Subarus. Anyway.
Anyways, so we've got a show.
We got a show today.
Yeah.
We do.
We do.
I'll take you guys through it. First up, we're going to be listening to the second half of a conversation that Rob had with Sam and Gia from the T Generation Gym, a trans-owned and operated gym in so-called Coburg. First half aired on 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility broadcast at the end of last month. And the segment will be picking up where we left off with Sam talking about building community of strong, resilient, trans and gender non-conforming people. And then we're going to be listening to a conversation from this Saturday's Asia Pacific Currents featuring the show's resident Iran expert, James Barry, about the ceasefire in Iran. They also discuss Israel's invasion of ethnic cleansing in Lebanon, dissent against the war in Israel, and the way out of its situation for us in the left. And then we're going to be listening to a conversation that me and my mum had when we went to Goongra and we interviewed Joe. He has a wildlife shelter and it's just a conversation with him walking to all of his animal enclosures and taking us through how he feeds all the animals in the night. And
I'm really excited for that one.
Yeah, it's really cute.
That's going to be awesome.
There's lots of ambient sound of bottles clanking.
Love so that.
Hey. Be warned for that. But, you know, it just, like, takes you there.
Yeah,
you can
it does.
Hear the little baby kangaroos sucking their little bottles. It's really cute. Aww,
sweet.
And then we'll be ending the show with a conversation with Randa Abel Fattah, the Palestinian-Australian author, about the disinvitation that was made by the Adelaide Writers Festival Board and the... Yeah. Yep.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's going to be a good show.
Yeah.
I'm super keen.
Me too.
Wee!
Should we get into headlines?
Yes, please.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Let's get right down.
These are the news headlines for Monday, the 13th of April, 2026. Listeners, please note that this headline contains mention of an Aboriginal person who has died, as well as deaths in custody. If this raises distress, you can contact 13YARN, a 24/7 crisis support line for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, on 139276. The coronial inquest into deaths in custody of Noongar man Geoffrey Winmar has concluded at the Coroner's Court of Victoria following 2 weeks of hearings into the circumstances surrounding his death in November 2023. Geoffrey died 2 days after being arrested by Victoria Police in an incident involving multiple officers, a canine unit and a drone. He became unconscious during the pursuit with questions around police conduct, delayed medical response, and systemic failures forming at the basis of the inquest pushed for by his family. Jeffrey is remembered by loved ones as a father, son, uncle, and a deeply valued member of his community. His mother, Ursula Winmar, spoke powerfully about the circumstances of his death and the broader patterns of deaths in custody, saying, quote, "My son did not deserve to die for the warrants out for his arrest. My son didn't deserve to have ambulances called twice while he was experiencing life-threatening critical incidents," end quote. "He didn't deserve to be treated less than human and stripped of his rights based off the color of his skin as a First Nations man. My son Jeffrey was failed. If our system is so just and so right, why do these deaths continue? Why is my son another statistic?" End quote. The inquest has now closed with findings and recommendations to be handed down at a later date. For many, this case is a part of a much longer struggle for justice, accountability, and an end to Aboriginal deaths in custody, a crisis that continues despite decades of inquiries and unanswered calls for systemic change.
Also in news this week, the Australian Broadcast Corporation is facing renewed scrutiny over its diversity, equity, and inclusions in activities as staff and media advocates question whether recent commitments are translating into real structural change. While the ABC has pointed to targets around workforce diversity and on-screen representation, critics say progress has been unevenly, particularly for First Nations, culturally diverse, and disabled workers. The Media, Entertainment and Arts Alliance has previously warned that diversity policies risk becoming symbolic without deeper institutional reform. A spokesperson has meaningfully changed requirements more than hiring targets. Diversity can't just be about who is visible on screen. It has to extend to who holds power behind the scenes. Without that, initiatives risk becoming tokenistic. Advocates say the debate reflects broader tensions within public broadcasting as communities push for media that reflects lived experience rather than producing dominant narratives. If the ABC is serious about a public broadcaster, it needs to be accountable to the full diversity of the public. This means shifting powers, not just optics.
And finally, National Environment Group Friends of the Earth Australia has announced significant downsizing as rise of cost of living pressures reduce monthly donations and forces cuts to key national roles. Positions including national liaison, campaigns coordination and IT support have been defunded, leaving the organization with reduced capacity at a time of escalating climate and environmental issues. In a message to supporters, national campaigner Cam Walker said the cuts reflect broader pressures facing grassroots movements across the country, saying, quote, "Like many other environmental groups, we have been impacted by the cost of living pressures," Walker said. And quote, "This has resulted in us having to take some difficult decisions, downsizing our core team," end quote. Despite the cuts, Walker said member groups continue to lead critical work on the ground, warning that without sustained support, frontline climate organizing risks being further undermined at a time that it is needed most. These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 13th of April. You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings. Cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
3CR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR. And first up, we're going to be listening to the second half of the conversation that Rob had with Sam and Gia from T Generation Gym, a trans-owned and operated gym in so-called Coburg. The first half was aired on 3CR's Trans Day of Audibility broadcast in late March. The segment will be picking up where we left off, with Sam talking about building a community of strong, resilient, trans and gender non-conforming people. You can listen to the first half of this conversation and more from the Trans Day of Audibility broadcast at 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026. Stay tuned.
But when you bring people together, you need to be very clear in your communication. You need to be very transparent in what you can and you cannot do. It's extremely important to us that we are empowering members of community, we are not enabling them. And hand on heart, absolutely, saviour complexes pop up. First few years, you try and do everything for everyone. And then you become the martyr in the story. And this is what happens in a lot of specially like marginalised led spaces. We all burn out and disappear within a few years because it's a slog, it's hard. So collectively as a team and as a community, we need to keep realigning back to the values, reconfirming why we are here, being very clear at points of what we can and what we can't do, not because we don't want to help, but because folks absolutely deserve the skill sets and the duty of care, especially in like the mental health space. We hold a lot of lived experience and we hold a lot of compassion, but we're not qualified psychologists. We are not mental health therapists. We would be doing a big disservice to community by trying to swipe everything under the roof, and this is how people get hurt. So being very, very clear on what you can and what you can't offer and what you are available for, which absolutely changes over time as your resource ability does. And it's one of those things that, for me, leaning into conflict, leaning into communication skills, having those hard chats. We're a space that doesn't have screens. We're a space where you are working directly with the person in front of you, seeing that human being there, regardless of how they look, how they don't, who's too trans, who's not too trans. I do not care. The human being in front of you is what matters, connecting back to people and community at the end of the day. And we've built it, whether it's programs, events, code of conducts, everything points back to the person in front of us.
Do you find that there's been parallels in learning to lift weights sustainably? Like, I find, especially for myself, lifting weights pretty seriously over the past like 3.5 years. Especially with building community and also like navigating your own mental health, you are very quickly put up with almost a hard wall, like you were saying, Sam, with, you know, like, this is what I can and can't do. This is what I shouldn't be doing. You know, like, I know in particular, like, and Gia and I speak about this a lot when they're training me, right? It's like, okay, like, your body's tired, your mind's tired, whatever's going on, you've had a hard day, you don't have to lift a freaking million kilos. You know what I mean? Like, you don't need to be doing it all the time. Do you think that has shaped your approach to community building?
Yeah, I think I know what you're talking about. and I guess you're referring to the pacing, the body needs to earn the right. Yeah, community building is not a one and done thing. You don't just slap up an event, you don't just do an Instagram post and bang, here comes community. The parasocial relationships online make things a lot more difficult. And there is, at least in my world and what I see at the moment, there's a real disconnect around optics, impact, what's real, what's not. The beauty of the weightlifting process and the gym process is the love of the journey. It's not the destination. It is like, you're not, it's the journey, it's the repetition, it's the flexing of the reps. I know for me, I unlearned deep levels of hustle culture through having to earn your stripes and submit to the process. And years of experience and reflection and some loving call-ins over the years from people doing a lot more work than me. Like, you will never get shit from anybody doing more than you. And I'm very grateful to my teachers, to my mentors over the years that have allowed me the space to distance myself from elements of attention economy, from hustle economy, from marching to the beat of your own drum. And that has allowed me some space, some depersonalization, some grace to be vulnerable and just be, I'm a human being. This is where I am. This is what we've got. This is what we're working towards. And I feel like that's a big piece missing in community building. Like, understandably, we don't want to upset people. We don't want to, quote unquote, perceive that we're letting people down or not, whether that is our own thoughts in the back of our head or not. But just having that vulnerable conversation of, well, here's where I am, here's where they go. Are you going to help me or are you going to sit up in the grandstands? That is a very essential part of community building, because real world, real time community building is messy at points. It is difficult, especially when you are dealing with complex folks. And like myself included, it's the slowness, not even the slowness is the word I would use. It has to be intentional, and you have to put your stop points. You have to have your breaks. You have to look to the long game, to like future horizon, like put it in the future, what it's going to look like. See that picture so clear. But then you've got to create your capacity framework of what does your just one step forward look like, that little bit at a time. Otherwise, it'll spend you a little bit, because the bigger community builds and the more that people come together, it brings lots of layers. And like, that's exciting, that's great, but you've just got to hold your pace and not get caught up in somebody else's race or somebody else's vision, so to speak. Did you have any thoughts on any of that, Chair? No, pass it back.
Okay. Yeah, we only have a few minutes left anyway, but I just wanted to end with, and I know we probably should have done this at the start of the interview, but maybe you'll want to talk about just, yeah, more formally what the powerlifting space, you know, like the capital P powerlifting space looks like for trans folks.
That's a big question. I suppose, like, do you mean, are you referring to like the actual federations? Look, truth be told, I'm actually not super familiar with it, because I choose not to involve myself in whatever the hell is going on over there. All these federations have different rules. They can't seem to get along. It's like some of them kind of want to include trans people, but then exclude certain trans people. And it's all a bit like, well, do you want us or not, mate? What I will say though, is that even though it's really, really scary, if you're a trans person, if one of these federations has like an MX category and you're a non-binary person who's like not taking testosterone and, you know, they allow you to go in, I know it's really, really scary. I've done it before. You know, you might even, if you search my legal alias, which I'm not telling you, you might find that perhaps I hold a few records. I can't remember if they're state or, I don't think they're national, they're state records. I've got 3 state records in the squat, bench press and deadlift. Because nobody else wants to be in the MX category. Nobody wants to go into these federations, but much like disabled toilets in like a government building or like any sort of institution, if they don't get used, they get removed. So I know it's really scary. I know it's not ideal, but if we do not use the space that they allow for us, they will remove it and it will be hard to get it back. But if we go in there and we do our thing, even though it's uncomfortable and scary, and we bring our crew along to support, they will be forced to open their categories up more and more because we will be there pushing the boundaries on what they allow for us, and it won't happen otherwise. So if you don't do it for yourself, do it for the younger trans people who need folks like you putting in the work today. It will be worth it. It'll definitely be worth it.
As someone that has been around in powerlifting with some of the federations for a while, I believe I was the second trans mask person to compete in a tested federation ever by a week. And I met the person that got it by a week. I'm like, okay, I'm glad you did, but damn it, 7 days. The comp was just a bit different. There's been a lot of change in the powerlifting federation space, and I've spoken to a few of the feds, a few of the boards. I definitely agree with Gia. A lot of them need to just get their shit together. But I'll get in trouble if I say certain things that I do know, but they know why they need to get their shit together. However, there is a new wave of governance coming in that are asking the right questions. They are reaching out. The biggest issue is, you know, folks don't want to tackle the HRT debate, even though all of the research by actual medical governance, endocrinologists and governance folks that know what they're doing have literally created the pathway. It just opens up a bigger conversation that no folks want to touch. The language that I would use with this is those with the capacity and the capability need to show up. In the MX categories, in the in all of the federations, just showing up at events, pushing into gyms, asking questions. There is actually a lot of allyship out there, but not a lot of education. Remember, this is by design. This is systemic. We are a community that is still trying to access our own lineage, our own history, our own knowledge. And I encourage folks to look beyond potentially the one wrong word or the wrong language to the humanity of the person in front of you that does want to help. Definitely within NAM and out of through Victoria, hand on heart, I'm the go-to person for most gyms around trans and gender diverse policies, language, etc. And I'm really glad to hear, Gia, that you're getting more people in your inbox and stuff too, because there is a lot of folks that do want to help. Show up, get some skill sets first. Come and see us. Go and tap whoever you need to on the shoulder to get in the room. Come check out Trans Takeover this year, which will be on November 15th. Oh, I hope that date's correct. We'll work it out. I think it's in the calendar. Like, come and see what it looks like. The Melbourne powerlifting scene, I see them come to Trans Takeover every year. I invite them into the room. They've been coming in there, and watching the ripple effect is beautiful. But it starts with each individual person taking a stand, just like we did, to show up, show out in all of your glory, and have them try and say no. Like, good luck. We literally have a gym of staunch, strong trans powerlifters now. It's like, try it, mate. Like, literally try it. Bless. Look, it's a lot of fun. Powerlifting is incredible. Strength sports are incredible. There are so many different movement modalities. If weights are not your vibe, there is nothing wrong with Pilates. There's nothing wrong with going for a run, but we just like the hitting the clangs and bangs a little bit more, and we encourage you to come hang out.
ACR, your station, your voice.
Then join Sally on Sundays at noon for Out of the Pan.
Welcome to Rainbows Don't Fade with Age on Radio 3CR.
Welcome to Trans Creator Radio.
Where history's queer futures is an audio journey into the
Trans Day of Audibility, a day for us to be heard and not seen.
3CR, your station, your voice.
You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. Before that little station ID, we were listening to a conversation that Rob had with Sam and Gia from T Generation Gym. You can listen to the first half of that conversation and more from the Trans Day of Audibility broadcast at 3cr.org.au/TDOA2026. From this Saturday's Asia Pacific Currents, featuring a conversation with the show's resident Iran expert, James Barry, about the ceasefire in Iran. They also discuss Israel's invasion and ethnic cleansing in Lebanon, dissent against the war in Israel, and the way out of this situation for us in the left. You can catch more of these conversations from the crew at Asia Pacific Currents on Saturdays from 9 to 9:30 a.m. or listen back at 3cr.org.au/AsiaPac.
It's been a couple of weeks since we've really kind of looked into and analysed the situation. Of course, you know, what was meant to be a quick in-and-out war like Venezuela has persisted some, I think we're in 12 weeks. Is this the 12th week of the war?
No, 6 weeks.
6 weeks? Yep. Oh, just hyperbole. You never went astray in left-wing politics. Let me ask you, in the last week a ceasefire has been announced, let's just get some facts on the table. What's the basis of the ceasefire?
So Pakistan brokered a ceasefire at the last minute. As many listeners would know, every Saturday when the markets are closed, Trump would threaten to attack Iran over the last couple of weeks, would threaten to escalate. They're already attacking Iran, obviously. And every Monday or Tuesday, he would then back down before his deadline. And I guess he was betting on the market. This last weekend, he threatened to wipe out Iranian civilization. By 8 a.m., I think, or 8 p.m. Monday, U.S. Eastern time. And just before that happened, Pakistan announced that they'd brokered a ceasefire deal between Iran and the U.S., accepting as a basis of negotiation, a 10-point plan by the Iranians. Now, that 10-point plan had a number of interesting things in it. One of the interesting things is, of course, that the document that was in Persian was different from the document that was in English, slightly different. But it included such things as recognizing Iran's sovereignty or right to charge for the use of the Strait of Hormuz, which has been a key area where the U.S. has been shown to be quite weak in being able to fight Iran. Lifting of all sanctions, the U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East. Of course, Iran is surrounded by U.S. bases. That's a big issue for them. An end to all attacks on Iran and its allies, including Lebanon. And a UN, the release of frozen assets and a UN Council resolution that would make it binding, because one of the things that Iran has said is, how do we know we're not going to be attacked again when we're negotiating? Because this attack happened by the US side to being fruitful negotiations. Now, they're an interesting bunch of points, because obviously you would expect the US is not going to accept most of them in their current form. But also, I mean, the US put forward a 15-point plan at the end of last month, which was also like ridiculous in terms of like saying to Iran, more one of the key points, or several of the key points, was that there was going to be no defense mechanisms at all. Like, Iran should get rid of its ballistic missile programs, its interceptors and everything, which of course no country would ever accept that if they were able to. The difference between the Persian and the English language points that were shared by the Iranian government was that the Persian language document said that Iran should be allowed to pursue enrichment to its nuclear enrichment to its heart's content, which, you know, even though the US has not been very clear on why they're actually fighting the war, and I think that, like you said, they thought it would be quick, easy and out, in and out like Venezuela, which I don't know why, who was advising them that that would be the case there, but that's what they thought. One of the key points that keeps coming up is Iran's nuclear program. Just on Iran's nuclear program, the US and Israel and others believe that Iran is making a weapon. Well, they're enriching it, because they are enriching at quite high levels. Iran has always said that they want to use it for civilian purposes. That probably isn't just the case, but it is. They do make an argument because they have tried to get nuclear power as a way of diversifying their energy sources. But so there's, you know, bit of everyone's telling lies and everyone's telling a bit of truth in that case.
I think the imperialist interests, though, are very clear. I think if the US was able to achieve control of the Strait of Hormuz, that would have been incredibly beneficial from an imperialist perspective. And I think what we're witnessing is the cost of not being able, well, the cost of the US not being able to control it, not that I'm in favour of the US controlling the Strait of Hormuz. But the other part of it too, what I think is less being discussed, obviously the war in Lebanon is being discussed, but it's not really being described in the mainstream press as an ethnic cleansing, a genocide of the south of Lebanon, encroaching further into that territory. Talk to me a little bit about what that front is, what it's about, why.
So on an official level, in terms of officially what the media is saying, the justification for Israel invading Lebanon is because Hezbollah, joined, as a proxy of Iran, started attacking when Israel started attacking Iran. But Israel, by Israel I mean the Israeli government and the Israeli media, have made a number of statements about what they actually their long-term goals in Lebanon are, which is an occupation of the south of Lebanon, possibly for the expansion of territory that they could use in settlements. The Litani River, which you know cuts across the south of Lebanon, is primarily where they have talked about the area they want to occupy. The Israeli government has been floating this as a permanent occupation, saying that officially that it would be about a buffer zone for those who you remember who've been following Israeli, Palestinian, Lebanese history for a while would know that Israel, they occupied the south of Lebanon for about 20 years. In Israel, it was called Israel's Vietnam because it was a complete failure of an occupation. But now in Israeli newspapers, there is talk about, and this happened in 2024 when there was another war with Hezbollah in Lebanon, they're talking about occupying the land and settling it. So the Israelis have seen settlements as both an area of expanding their power, but also a way of dealing with the high cost of living within Israel itself. They've been using the West Bank settlements as a means of having cheaper land for people, and it looks like they want to do the same in Lebanon. 1.1 million people have been displaced in this process. That is maybe a quarter or more of Lebanon's population. And there's a lot of, you know, Lebanon's a small country. I've been there. There's not much place to move around. It's when you move 1.1 million people, it's going to have a much more tremendous effect. It's already, 1.1 million people, when you think about it, it is already a huge number of people. But in an area as small as that, it's profound, the damage it's done. But yeah, overall, that's the long-term goal. And in Israel itself, there's complete support for this war. Their media is tightly controlled anyway. Anything that goes wrong is blamed on a non-existent left. And the real goal for the Prime Minister of Israel is to stay out of jail. He wants perpetual war. He wanted to have that in Gaza. He couldn't have that in Gaza. So he's going to create a perpetual war elsewhere, and that probably is going to be in Lebanon for the time being.
It strikes me that a ceasefire then wouldn't exactly be in the interests of the Israeli Prime Minister. And what we've seen over the last couple of days, you know, is that an attempt to perpetuate the perpetual war? If there is some kind of durable peace, what does this mean for Israel's war ambitions?
So with the Israelis or with Netanyahu and his group, one of the problems is if they do stop the war, then he has to deal with his other cabinet members who are always telling him, no, we want a war, and we'll break from the cabinet, we'll break from the government if you don't. So what they tend to do is say that there's a ceasefire and then just continue attacking. That's usually it. This time they haven't not even said there's a ceasefire. They said, oh, we're not party to the ceasefire, but we're going to negotiate with the Lebanese government. But then they're continuing to attack. Like we saw a day after the ceasefire was announced, the deadliest day in Lebanon in this current conflict. And it was just hitting apartment buildings and hitting health centers and just like horrible stuff. So their idea is just to push Trump and his short attention span, take advantage of his short attention span as long as they can. Of course, Iran doesn't want that at all. And Iran has threatened to break the ceasefire if it's not adhered to. So yeah, the Israelis just say, well, we're not party to it. It's an American-Iranian agreement. And but we'll negotiate with the Lebanese, but then they just keep attacking. So they want to keep, that's how they're trying to find ways just to perpetuate it, keep it going.
I did want to ask you, because you talked about Israelis being completely on board with their government in this time. But we are seeing suppressed media, I appreciate, but still some attempt at resistance in Israel, some mass protests in the streets opposing the war, opposing the government. What do you say about that?
So that group of people who are protesting, they're quickly being silenced. I know there were protests in Tel Aviv that were, I think they were arrested for protesting. I guess the overwhelming support argument for in Israel is based on polling that's been done recently on supporting the war, which was like more than 80%. I think for the Israeli Jewish population, which is 80% of the population, is like 90% support the war. And the rhetoric is that, oh, Iran is a nuclear threat to Israel, so this war is about Iran. So when it's put to Israelis like that, then that's fine. But it is also putting a stress on in their lives. No one's sleeping in their beds at the moment because they're having to go to shelters every night because of the missiles. The head of the military said that the pressure on reservists and the pressure on the army is so great that they're not able to achieve their goals. So it isn't just a simple case of that. Yeah, of course, they completely support every aspect of the war. But when it's put to Israelis that, oh, this is about getting rid of the Iranian threat, and Iran has been a boogeyman for Israelis for a long, long time, past 20, 30 years, then that's the reason why they say, oh, yeah, we're totally on board for that.
I think we're quickly coming to the end of the time that we've got, but I did want to, while we're talking about internal dissent, thought it was worth talking about where things are internally in Iran, though it is under immense military pressure at the moment. There were significant people's uprisings at the end of last year, seemingly all suppressed, or it's just not the time to be fighting your government when your government's being fought by imperialism. What do you say about where the internal movement of dissent is at in Iran and what that means for the stability of the Iranian government at these times?
It's impossible to know because we can't contact people in Iran. The internet is shut off. Their communications are shut off. But even if we could, you wouldn't easily get a clear picture of that. What I would suspect, and this is, you know, one of these sort of common themes that is accepted as what you would expect in Iran is that when Iran is under attack, the ability for those who are opposed to the government to succeed is much less because, as you see in other countries as well, people can hate their government, but they hate a foreign government invading them more. And you don't win people over by bombing them. So even if it doesn't mean that they love the Islamic Republic of Iran, but they're not going to love Israel or the United States bombing them more. So, it's not going to necessarily bolster support for the regime, but it's definitely going to make the regime more militarized and therefore making it harder for an uprising to be effective.
And just by way of closing remarks, what do you say about the prospects of negotiations at this point and any possibility of ending the war?
It's hard to tell because there's so much volatility. Obviously, we've seen the American red line is having oil prices and energy prices going up. They're not willing to keep fighting for that. They say that they've achieved their goals, that there's a regime change in Iran, which is, you know, they've installed a monarchy, which is the Khamenei monarchy. It's hard to tell. The Iranians are going to push to have further control of the Straits of Hormuz. You'd assume that they'd all negotiate down. But in some ways, it looks like Iran has done quite well. If Iran is able to get sanctions relief or something out of this, even though they don't necessarily have much security, it's going to be better for them. The United States has also exhausted itself a little bit militarily, and that doesn't bode well for other conflicts that may appear in the coming years, such as in the Pacific.
I guess that leaves it, folks, incumbent upon us as the left to build what seems impossible to build right now, an international mass movement in opposition to global warfare. Kieran, prospects of success on that question?
Well, it's socialism or barbarism as always, and yet the challenge is definitely before us.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show here at 3CR, and we were just listening to this Saturday's Asia Pacific Currents show featuring a conversation with the show's resident Iran expert, James Barry, about the ceasefire in Iran. Up next, we're going to be listening to a conversation that me and my mum had with Joe from the Wallaby Wildlife Shelter, and he takes us through his nightly routine of feeding the animals at his shelter. Stay tuned. Okay, so we're here with Joe from the Wallaby Wildlife Shelter. Do you want to talk us through what we're doing right now?
Going to feed. We've got to drop off at the aviary and feed the possum first, and then going to feed, give bottles to 7 kangaroos, 3 redneck wallabies and 3 wombats. So
how long have you had this possum for?
We've had her for about 2.5 months. So.
And how did she get brought in? How are you looking after her?
She was brought in as an orphan. To remember now. She was just, her mum was killed on the road, I think, so it's a bit hard to remember everyone now.
Yeah.
But yes, I think her mum was killed on the road, so.
And what about these kangaroos? How long have you had these ones for?
These guys, most of them we've had now for about 7 months.
And how do you usually get animals? How
people will call us, or they'll come from other carers who look after them when they're young. Often just members of the public, Wildlife Victoria, or we have sort of large enclosures that can handle adult animals. So
take me through this feeding process.
She's actually being weaned off milk now. And she's we're starting to do the weaning her off fruit. As you can see, we've got leaves all through the enclosure, so we'll wean her down off her fruit before she's released. So she can pretty much just survive off a wild diet. And the fruit's just a supplement. She used to get protein powder with the fruit, so a protein supplement. Because she would be drinking milk for longer, but you can't really. If you keep them on milk for too long, the brushies can get a bit more dependent. So,
And it's night time. So, do you always feed them at night, or do you feed them during the day as well?
The kangaroos and wombats, we do feed during the day because they're getting milk feeds, and when they're small, they'll get feeds during the day. These guys, the ones we're going to now get. There's one group in there that's older that are getting 2 feeds a day, and they come out during the day of the enclosure, and then and go back in at night, and there's everyone else gets 3 feeds a day. So,
and how long have you been looking after animals for?
Since about 2004, so 20 something years.
And how did you get into it?
I hit a wallaby in the car. It had a joey. We had friends who were wildlife carers at the time. And we talked to a lot of people who were caring to find out the right way of doing it, and then got registered under what is now DECA. And did trainings, did some trainings, and we have a foster, so in the Victorian system you have an experienced shelter who advises you. Hey guys, are you all okay with people? Okay.
Oh, and you have 2 little wombats in here.
Yes. Okay guys, we'll come to you in a second.
So there's what, about 8 kangaroos and
3 wallabies.
3 wallabies.
Oh, 7 kangaroos and 3 wallabies.
So how many bottles are you holding in your hands right now?
10.
And you can feed all 10 of them at once? Yeah.
Just have to, it's a slow process to get started. But,
So you're being mobbed right now?
Yeah.
Do they all have different milks or?
It's all the same milk, but they actually do have, they kind of drink differently. So we do have separate teats for them, for the individuals. So we know some of them drink faster and some of them drink slower. And Winter, you're standing off, are you? And we're going to have to feed you separately. Okay.
And how do you come up with all of the names for these?
A lot of them get named either by members of the public or... other people name them or we just name them. I don't know how we come up with all the names. We have different methods. What are you doing, sweetie?
Personality-based?
Yeah, personality. Sometimes it just happens.
I'm impressed by all the bottles you can hold at once.
Yes. We've tried different things, and sometimes some people have, like, things that can hold multiple bottles, but I have actually found it harder to do it that way than this way, so...
And with the wombats that are behind you...
Yeah.
How do you feed them?
The same bottles. They're bottle fed at the moment, so you just sit down and they drink pretty well.
So you've got, what, 10 babies on bottles now and 2 wombats and the possum. That's, what, 13 animals plus a pinky.
Yeah.
Baby wallaby, 14. Yeah. So that's a lot of work for you by yourself as a volunteer. Like, how many hours a day? What's your day look like?
Okay, so the pinky's on 6 feeds a day, so I will I get up every 4 hours to feed the pinky. I will, let's say, I start at 5, I get up, do the pinky, and then I do these guys after that. And then I will do the pinky again. I've got to wash bottles and make milk often, so that fits in somewhere. And then I'll usually come and clean up the poo in the enclosure, or enclosures, and... Every day or 2 days, I'll get possum food somewhere through the day. And then 4 of these guys go out, as I said, during the day. And then...
Outside of the enclosure?
Yeah, outside of the enclosure. They're getting sort of ready for release.
So what's the possum food? Is that when you say go...
Oh, the possum food, we get branches and like eucalypts and wattles and stuff that we fill up the enclosure with.
Driving around with secateurs and...
Yep, and saws and just cutting stuff. It's fairly easy from this property at the moment because we burnt. We've got a lot of young eucalypts and stuff coming up anyway, so the collection's not too bad at the moment. And then, yes, then pretty much milk feeds. And so this time at night, that alarm was me running a little bit late for the pinky, so I've got to feed the wombats and then... go and do the pinky again after these guys, and then I get up a few times in the night to do the pinky. So,
and who pays for all of the milk?
We've paid for a lot of it with donations that we've got over the years. We still and then we get a bit of grant money that pays for some of the milk but doesn't pay for all of it. So DECA usually have grants once a year, which is $1,500, but that doesn't cover very much of the milk considering we go through 600, like a 20 kilo bag, which is over $600 usually, like in a bit over a month.
Wow.
Or a bit under a month actually now. So we, and then so we sort of go through a lot of milk. So like have been going through, I think it's been about four weeks now for a bag of food. And they get like, so the pinky's on a different milk formula than these guys. Doesn't have that much, but these guys are quite big, so they get a lot more. And then there's also pellets. We give them, like, we give these guys pellets during the day and hay. But yeah, pretty much if we've been running off donations for a while, but our donations are running pretty low, so we're like, are going into savings as well. And before the fires in 2020, we got a lot of donations from then, and before that we've paid for everything ourselves. So.
Yeah.
And what's your success rate like in terms of releasing them?
We release ones to where they're returned, and these are local roos that we release here.
Mm-hmm. But the local ones that you release into the local mobs,
yeah,
they integrate pretty well with the wild roos?
They integrate really well with the wild groups. And so we're still, that's part of the reason why we do let them out during the day, because for a few reasons. One, this enclosure is probably a little bit small for kangaroos because they really run big distances and they like to run big distances, but it lets them assimilate slowly with the wild mob, and they assimilate really well with the wild mobs.
Yeah.
Here, and it takes a bit of time for them to integrate, and but also we have to release them as a group, so they will hang out with each other for ages. Some of them will hang out with each other for their entire lives, pretty much.
Yeah. What are the age ranges of?
So Winter's probably the youngest here, who's a roo, and she's about 14 months. So they usually, oh no, she's probably about 13. Yeah, 13 months probably. Maria is, the wallabies would be about, the smallest wallaby would be about 14 months as well. And she's probably about 15 months, Maria here. So, or 16 months here. Yeah, 15 or 16 months.
And if people want to donate to your wildlife shelter, how do they go about doing that?
We do have a Facebook page, and I think we've got the bank details on the Facebook page at the moment. So
that's Wallabia Wildlife
Shelter.
Wildlife Shelter.
Yep. So WALLABIA. So you just have to. Yeah, it's the first part of the scientific name of Swamp Wallaby. So.
You're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. We were just listening to a conversation with Joe from the Wallabia Wildlife Shelter based in Goongra in Far East Gippsland. If you want to donate to their shelter and help him pay for food and all of the things that they need to look after the animals, go to Wallabia, WALLABIA, Wildlife Shelter on Facebook, and their bank details are on there.
Palestine, your station, your voice.
Palestine is not just the land of the Muslims. It's the land of three people and all people. The land of the Muslims, the land of the Christians, and the land of the Jews who are decent and not Zionist Jews. When we say from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, that does not mean that we are going to get rid of the Jews from that land. We are saying that it's going to be one state of Palestine, the historic Palestine, where the Jews and the Christians and the Muslims can live side by side peacefully.
3CR, your station, your voice.
telephone book. Maybe I should give it up again, again. I am exercising how good it feels to be alive, and no surprises up my sleeve. Everything is temporary. Ooh, praying mantis on my door, looking for meaning or just any sign at all. Ooh, organizing all my thoughts, making them rhyme, choosing wisely where I spend my time. Ooh, give me midnight love again, feeling so
when I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this feast with a carrot, and carrots are my favorite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter. Food Not
Bombs. Before that Food Not Bombs CSA, we were listening to Mantis from Courtney Barnett's new album, Creature of Habit. Louise Adler's resignation as director of Writers
Adelaide Writers Week in January this year followed the cancellation of scheduled appearance of Palestinian Australian author Rhonda Abdel Fattah. The decision to disinvite Abdel Fattah was made by the Adelaide Festival Board despite Adler's strong opposition. The cancellation of the event led to significant backlash, with over 180 participants boycotting ADL Writers Fest, raising wider concerns about the impact of pro-Israel lobbying on free speech and democratic institutions. And since this time, the Adelaide Festival Board expresses regret over the stress caused and has apologised to Abdel Fattah. Up next, the two women met again recently in ADL on the 1st of March at an event presented by Australian Friends of Palestine Association in conversation focusing on Rhonda's latest novel, Discipline. In this excerpt of their discussion, they speak on cultural safety in the context of other similar examples of cancellations and how Zionism is not a cultural identity, should be subject to same normative interrogation as any ideology, and her experiences of social media and the role of mainstream media in mischaracterization of her own tweets, etc. You can listen back to the full edited and edited recording between publisher Louise Adler and Australian-Palestinian writer, rights activist and academic Rhonda Abdel Fattah at the Tuesday Hometime program at 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday.
Acres of column inches have been devoted to a couple of your social media comments, and I wanted to ask you about a couple of them specifically. The idea of cultural safety, I've listened to you explain it, and I wondered whether you would explain it for this audience. What you mean by cultural safety, I think that it's been taken by Zionists to imply that their physical safety is imperiled in spaces that Palestinians might speak, or that's what's at risk. And so I wondered if you could tease out for us what the notion of cultural safety actually means.
Yeah, well, in your opening remarks, Louise, you spoke about the importance of context and how mainstream media is almost programmed to decontextualize everything that we say and do. And so the context of my intervention on social media, in which I said that Zionists do not have the right to cultural safety, is really key to understand. It was in the context of the State Library of Victoria cancelling a series of online writing workshops with writers and poets of colour, and they cited as the reason the cultural safety of the children who were going to participate. So basically implying that the workshops to be run by these Arab and writers of colour and diverse writers would put these children at risk, that they were culturally unsafe for them. And then at Wamalade Festival, there was an electronic dance company, I think 47, it's not my genre of music, but a Palestinian electronic dance group who were also cancelled. And this reason was cited again, cultural safety. On top of that, we were seeing at the time, this is March 2024, and it's very important for me to foreground this, and because it continues until today, the privileging of one group's sensitivities and feelings and emotions over the facts of a genocide. We are living in a world in which what we are being told is to deny the evidence of what we can see and defer to the feelings of those who support and sympathize with our genocide. Hanan Ashrawi, after the Oslo Accords, said that they have made the occupied responsible for the security of their occupiers. And I liken it to they have made the victims of a genocide responsible for the feelings of those who support their genocide. And I refuse that. I refuse it because there's a difference between facts and feelings. And there was a Palestinian in a refugee camp in Haifa in 1948 who said a line that has stuck with me in her memoir. She was repeatedly told by Western powers that she had voluntarily migrated to Lebanon in a refugee camp in 1948, and she was part of the Nakba. And she said, "Zionist deeds are more eloquent than Zionist words." Likewise, African-American novelist James Baldwin said, "I don't believe what you say, because I can see what you do. And this is the crux of the matter. We are constantly asked to defer to the feelings of people while we see the dismembered bodies of Palestinian babies on our screens. And that is the essence of the racism that we are confronting. That is why I intervene to say that if you are a Zionist, a political ideology, there's no such thing as Zionist DNA, Zionist food. You're not born a Zionist. It is a political ideology. And like all political ideologies, communism, settler colonialism, liberalism, it should be subject to the same normative interrogation as any ideology. And as a person who works in the academic space, the art space, if a student were to stand up in class and start to speak in defense of white supremacy, in defense of segregation, racial segregation, or if a misogynist stood up and said, men are superior to women, if a settler colonialist sympathizer were to stand up and say, I have the right to steal this group's land and to build my state on top of it, we would shut that down. And yet we are being asked to exceptionalize the ideology of Zionism. And so no, racialized communities, racialized peoples have the right to cultural safety. It's actually a concept that comes from Maori nursing educators that actually comes out of the experiences of violence and colonization, which says that racialized communities and people have the right to cultural safety, not ideologies. And that's the distinction. Jews have the right to cultural safety. Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, ideologies don't. They should be subject to interrogation and critiqued. And that is the fundamental difference, that the people who are attacking me want to protect an ideology that argues for the dispossession of my people's land, that argues for settler colonialism, that argues for genocide, to be exempt from criticism. Where is my cultural safety as a Palestinian? If you rob me of my right to use my political language to analyze what is happening to my people, where is my cultural safety? How am I supposed to talk about my liberation and my people's freedom if you are taking the very words from my mouth? What is left for me then? And that is, again, the heart of the question here, that who we are as Palestinians is so deeply dehumanized that that did not ever come up. That those who claim the right to cultural safety have never given me my right to cultural safety as a Palestinian.
So that explanation, that teasing out of what you had in mind when you used the term, you know, it's a nuanced, sophisticated, comprehensive arguing of a position. The tweets that you've crafted, they are undifferentiated, they're not your tweets, but the reception of them, or some would say that the tweets are not nuanced or not subtle enough or not sophisticated or not contextualized enough. So how do you balance, you know, you're thinking about your use of social media, how do you think about that, given the explanation you've just given us, which, you know, seems to me to be completely cogent, and I happen to agree with it, but that's not the point. But why bother with social media, for example, if all that the response you get on social media is to trivialise, demonise, and vilify, contort, distort what you've had to say or what you're thinking about?
I've really been reflecting on this, given the controversy and mischaracterization of my tweets, and actually the way that the lobby almost conducts an audit of what I've said online and picks and chooses and cherry picks for a political campaign and agenda. When I go back to the tweets, the ones that have been recycled the most in Senate hearings and Murdoch Press, and even by, you know, politicians on all sides, one thing that I realize is that as a Palestinian, you don't have the right to an emotion, to rage, to anger. You don't have that right. Every time you say something in public, you must add an academic reference. You must add something to legitimize and provide an alibi to your political agency, because your victim impact statement is never enough. So if I had provided some citations to a tweet, maybe I would have been protected. But I think about it now, because it's like what I said to you before about the 3D glasses. People just don't understand the level of ongoing trauma every single day is. Some of those tweets conveniently people ignore the fact that I quote tweeted, which means I shared material underneath it. That was the context. One of them was the attack on a hospital in which a journalist was standing outside with four other journalists waiting for his wife who was giving birth, and he was killed in a bomb. The other one was the babies on New Year's Day, I think, or New Year's Eve 2025, who were frozen to death because of the blockade. And so very often we are watching horror upon horror upon horror, and there were times the only, like you said, the only available space we have is social media. I would have loved to write an opinion piece about cultural safety, but every single opinion piece I've ever sent to The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald or to The Guardian gets knocked back. And so instead of a nice long essay, I get 140 characters. That is what we are left with. And I understand now the space we are in is so malicious and vexatious and dangerous, given the way that lawfare is now being used against us, that we don't even have the luxury to express our rage or anger, despite the horror that we are witnessing.
Well, we're witnessing, I'm just thinking about the catalogue of instances in the last couple of years where universities, arts organisations, media organisations have been under attack. While we're live streaming, we're witnessing a live stream genocide in Gaza. And I think you've said that you think that these have been the greatest source of repression and gaslighting. Do you think, taking a broader view of it, that this is the latest iteration for, you know, the lobby, the Murdoch press, however we want to describe the forces arraigned against the kind of discussion you're hoping to have, that this is the latest iteration of the culture wars? When I look at, you know, the Gillian Siegel report card that Greg Craven's to have on universities, for example, or, you know, the late, you know, what happened to Bendigo or to Khalid Sabsabi or however many other instances, or, you know, here in Adelaide and the Premier's actions. Do you think it's a refreshed, revised form of the culture wars? Or maybe it's never ended, maybe we're just perpetual, you know, sort of, we've had a long time of this, but do you think that's what's going on?
I think it borrows from the culture wars, it uses the culture wars to legitimise the work that it's doing, but I think that the objective and the agenda is to shield Israel from critique. I think that it can package it in some coverage as culture wars, particularly around the arts, and we have seen that, you know, all the woke leftists criticising conservative voices, and because that will appeal to a certain demographic. I mean, I see racists very much as lazy. They will use a smorgasbord and they'll take whatever they can consume from it that's going to work. And so in some articles, it's very much couched as the culture wars, and a lot of the coverage around us was about that. On the other hand, I think it's important to understand this moment since October and the repression and the collusion between the state and institutions and the way that they are ingratiating themselves and appeasing Hasbara propaganda and these tactics to silence us is very, it's political work, and it's very much about silencing and crushing our voices about a genocide. And I think that's the reason why we're seeing it, the reason why we're seeing this escalate and get even worse is because they've lost. You know, this is the beast thrashing around. They've lost an entire generation. You can't tell them, no, kids aren't starving, when they're looking at their iPhones at lunchtime in the schoolyard and seeing the emaciated babies' bodies. We are defending ourselves and they're setting dogs on a Down syndrome boy or shooting children in the head. The catalogue of horror is ongoing and it beggars belief even to articulate it. But young, there's a whole generation who can see that. And so because they've lost that, well, we know because of the billions that are being poured into social media to silence and to control and to shadow ban, the only thing left for them is not dialogue, it's not expressing ourselves, it's not giving us any platforms, it's to crush and silence us. That coercive, you know, force of the state has come down on us. And I think that's that the culture wars serve that purpose.
And it's interesting, though, at the level of language that, you know, the lexicon seems to me to be shifted. I'm not being a Pollyanna here, but 2 years ago, terms like genocide or apartheid would have been so transgressive. They would have been taboos. That's a real shift, isn't it? And we're talking about the West. We're talking about Western, well, the Western world, the West, even the Western media have crept very ever so timidly towards using that kind of language.
Because hundreds of thousands of people have been slaughtered, and even still it takes a lot of effort for some people to still use those words. But I do feel as well that it's because now it's undeniable and the weight of evidence. I mean, everything that Palestinians have been telling you for decades has been ignored. It was only when, you know, UN reports and outsiders and Westerners validated the evidence of the native that people started to maybe use that language. So there's a lot of anger and bitterness from us as Palestinians about that as well, because our actual lived experience has never been enough. How many interviews we did before October 2023 where we would fight with journalists about using the language of what we could see, occupation, illegal occupation, settler colonialism, apartheid, racism, and all of it was always a struggle. You know, we would send an article back in the day where I had some hope of an article, and it would just be, can you change this word? Can you change that word? It was a constant back and forth. You were never considered reliable. You always needed an alibi. But I think, yeah, there's been a shift now because it is undeniable. You know, as Palestinians, we say, the price that we have paid for the world to see what we have been saying for over 78 years.
And that was This World Couldn't See Us by Nabiha Iqbal. And before that track, we were listening to Louise Adler and Randa Abdel Fattah having a conversation at the Australian Friends of Palestine Association. And before that, we heard a conversation that me and my mum had with Joe from the Wallabia Wildlife Shelter based in Goongra in Far East Gippsland, where he takes us through his nightly routine of feeding the animals. And before that, we heard a conversation with Asia Pacific Currents resident Iran expert James Barry speaking about the ceasefire in Iran and Israel's invasion and ethnic cleansing in Lebanon. And first on the show, we were listening back to a conversation that Rob had with Sam and Gia from T Generation Gym, a trans-owned and operated gym in so-called Coburg. And that was the show.
Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks for listening.
It was so fun. Stay tuned.
Women on the Line, up next.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.